echoed Zeed. Copley grinned. With respect, the scent of an Adeptus Astartes is very distinctive.
She's telling you to take a bath, Paperface, laughed Voss.
Zeed almost got a retort off, but Karras cut in. The Tau have a highly sensitive olfactory sense, like a guard dog's. He looked at Copley. That could be a problem for us going in. Copley shook her head.
Not if you wear your helms. Ordo stealth enhancements to your armor suppress scent traces. Epsilon's bodyguards will have had their helms off as they moved among the Tau.
In any case, said Routh, it's clear that we have to hit Alel Atarag, and fast, before things change.
I've been here far too long already without a foe to kill, said Zeed.
Do we know what she's doing there, exactly? Asked Karras.
She's clearly no prisoner, said Copley. At least, not in the sense of others there.
We know she is involved in some kind of activity in the subterranean levels of the central block, said the speaker. The doctor has seen her twice only. Both times she was entering restricted vetors that led to lower levels. Both times she was in the company of armed fire warriors and her two space marines.
She had a full kill team, said Salarian.
Where are the others? Copley shook her head. We have to consider that she may not want to be extracted. She may resist.
They all processed that silently for a moment.
What she wants is irrelevant, said Karras at last. We have orders. The Ordo Xenos is calling her back in.
Getting in and out of there doesn't look like a very easy proposition, said Voss. Look here, and here. This whole facility is as much a military base now as it ever was a prison. These towers on the encircling blast walls all have anti-air defenses. These structures here are almost definitely fire-cast barracks. That's an armory there. Given the size, I'd expect problematic hardware inside.
Zeed leaned forward and gestured to another area.
These are training grounds. See? This is a firing range. These are combat training areas. It looks like this rooftop here is built to handle a small to medium-sized aircraft. Nothing bigger than a light transport, but it will be an issue if they have reinforcements within fast response range.
Significant entrenched assets, said Salarian. A difficult and very limited approach by air, potential enemy reinforcement during the op, and far too many unknowns.
This is damned little to work with. Gaining and maintaining situational control will be a tall order from the start.
MSRs? Asked Routh.
The speaker looked at him quizzically.
Main supply routes, explained Copley.
Turning back to Routh, she said,
a single road running northwest, and another running southeast. Both depend on several bridges to cross the canyon network on the way into the tower.
Some good news at least, grunted Salarian.
Blow the bridges, and we can at least isolate the facility from ground-based support.
Copley nodded to Canis and said,
a chance for the Kashtu fighters to aid in the attack.
Canis and the other warband leaders, each sporting a thick black beard and facial tattoos, all looked at their prophet leader simultaneously. The false speaker smiled at them.
A chance for our warriors to earn great honor and strike against the Blueskins openly. How could we refuse?
White smiles cracked those typically dour faces, teeth shining against the black of their beards.
We will hit them hard, insisted one called Garam, and soak the sands blue.
Karras shook his head. Under cover of stealth, you will rig their bridges and blow them. After that, if you must engage their infantry for your own satisfaction, you may do as you wish. Not before. Is that clear? The rebel leaders were not used to being addressed so, but this was a space marine. They bowed, and in obedient tones replied,
as you will it, Reshpa.
The false speaker spoke next.
Alel Atarag has never been attacked. The Tau charged with defending the bridges and patrolling the local area will have become complacent. I know my people can cut off those routes. Reinforcements by air, however, I cannot comment on.
We'll handle that if it comes up, said Karras.
If Epsilon were on the move, said Salarian, it would be a damned sight easier to hit a convoy.
I concur, said Voss.
Copley shook her head. We can't sit and wait for that. Our orders were clear. Locate and extract her as soon as possible. As far as we know, they still have no idea we're here. We need to go hard while that's still true. Situation superiority.
Getting in there unseen will be the first test, said Karras. Just how do you plan to achieve it, Major? Darkness means little to Tau battlesuits. Camouflaged or not, there's only one viable approach to the valley, right along the canyon. The turret defenses studding the walls will be AI-controlled. They don't feel fatigue. They never sleep. Even stealthed. Our storm ravens will be detected with plenty of time for them to fire on us. If there's no back door, no way to strip those defenses before an air approach. No one disagreed. Special Forces doctrine depended on maintaining situational advantage for as long as possible. The smaller force had to keep things stacked in their favor by any means available. There had to be something, that would assure them at least a chance. Having heard Karras out, the false speaker nodded to one of the bodyguards at his side. The man moved off at once, leaving the strategium via a door in the rear wall. Zeed threw a quizzical look at Karras. But before Karras could offer any response, the door slid open again and the bodyguard returned, followed by a shrunken, half-lame old man with a carved wooden crutch. Those assembled watched with varying levels of patience as the old man shuffled towards the hololithic table. When he stopped, leaning on his crutch to support himself, he was breathing hard. Still, he managed to bow his head and with all the reverence he could muster, say,
"My lords, it is truly the greatest honor."
The speaker moved to the old man's side, placed a gentle hand on his frail shoulder, and smiled down at him.
"This," he told Karras and the others proudly, "is Morhad Ganin. This is the man who will guide you. It is Ganin, beloved of the tribe, who will get you inside the tower."
"He can hardly stand under his own power," Salarian said with a sneer. "What qualifies him for the task?"
The false speaker looked across at Salarian, meeting those cold grey eyes unflinching. A smile creased his face. It was Aga's smile. All her motherly warmth and patience glowed there. Karras alone could see it. The false speaker's aura radiated with Aga's own energy.
"He is the only man who can," she told them through her son, "because he is the only living man ever to escape from the tower alive. If the famed Lizard in Shadow cannot get you inside Alel Atarag, no one can."
Chapter 22. So much cooler down here in the lower levels. Such a relief from the heat above. Gloomier, too, with no apertures to spill blazing daylight into the room, and less artificial lighting than the upper levels. The relative gloom reminded her of the sconce-lit corridors of Imperial ships, of the dark sanctity of Ministorum chapels and Inquisition Libraria. It made her feel more comfortable than she ought to, among the hated aliens. She glanced sidelong at the figure on her left.
"Shas O Takan Jaikal."
Shas O, his rank, commander. Takan, his planet. Tychonis to the Imperium. His, for now only.
and Jaikal, his name, the name by which she called him in her mind. Cold Wave. He stood unblinking, unmoving, waiting for the procedure to begin. They'd both watched it before, of course, and more than enough times. But Epsilon never tired of it, never tired of the thrill that this might lead, as so desperately hoped, to something unprecedented and powerful, something that could change everything in the war with the Yahei. Cold Wave, for his part, seemed to watch out of some dark duty, a penance, a need to give witness to the horrors in which he was colluding for the sake of his race. He had returned earlier that day with the latest shipment of prisoners from Chuzut-Kar. Before them now, on the other side of the impenetrable plaz, was the first of those prisoners to be processed. If the Fire Warrior felt her looking at him, he gave no sign. He kept his eyes straight ahead, but she could see how tense he was. His fists were clenched, his jaw was tight. Silently, privately, she enjoyed his suffering. She might have to work with him now, but no amount of cooperation would ever override the deep training and conditioning the Ordo had given her. The Tau were the lesser of two evils. But their turn would come, and the Imperium would erase their species.
But not while they are useful.
She turned back to the room beyond, where Earth-cast Tex was strapping the lightly drugged Tau dissident down onto an operating table. This one was male, slight of build, with the fine-boned features of the water caste. She wondered at the percentages. How many of the Rauk'na belonged to each caste? Were there more fire-caste rebels than earth or air or water? The Tau would never let her see that data. What they allowed her was so carefully managed. She, of course, never told them any more than she wanted or needed them to know. She and the Xenos were locked in a strange dance of lies, half-truths, and uncomfortable cooperation.
And all because of Al-Rashak.
She would never have come this far if not for the discovery in the ruins of that tyrannid-ravaged world. Not what she had been looking for, but so important that it immediately superseded everything else, even Blackseed. And though the strange, flinty smell of the Tau and their clicking, jabbering ways of speech grated on her badly, she would endure anything for the possibility to serve the Imperium as few on record ever had. She alone, after all, had finally found proof of that legendary, half-mythical installation. In all these thousands of years, only she. Cold Wave muttered something in Tau, not caring to slow or enunciate his speech for her benefit. It didn't matter. Epsilon's skills were sharp. She caught it.
"They are ready to begin," he'd said.
She saw the Earth-cast Tex hastily retreating from the room beyond the plaz, saw the prisoner struggling uselessly against his bonds. The drugs were wearing off now. The prisoner began shouting, railing in the Tau tongue against the Tex as they left.
"What are you doing? What is this? Release me! I have done no wrong!"
The Tex vanished through a portal to the right. Heavy doors hissed shut behind them, followed by the click-clunk of near-unbreakable locks. Seconds later, a large rectangular panel in the ceiling began to lower itself on thick hydraulic pistons. Through the audio relay in the room, Epsilon could hear wet, hissing breaths. The prisoner turned his eyes up towards the end of the panel that was descending towards him. Slowly, it came into view, a figure in clamps, restrained just as he was, and yet not like him at all. The dissident cried out in desperate fear and anguish.
"We are enemies by birth," thought Epsilon. "But we share the same nightmare, and we face the same terrible darkness."
The panel continued to descend. The monstrosity clamped securely to its upper side was limbless, arms and legs amputated, utterly unable to move anything but its grotesque head and neck. It was no less terrifying for all that, however. The Tau prisoner was wailing hysterically now, begging for aid, for forgiveness and release. Ancient tales of terror, fell visions of monsters glimpsed in sleep, none compared to the horrible reality of the visage that fixed its pale violet eyes on him. Hungry, eager, unfeeling eyes. Its jaw opened. Long, sharp teeth glistened with saliva.
"I am Tau!"
screamed the Rauknar, eyes finding cold waves beyond the glass.
"Do not do this to me! I am your own!"
Epsilon cast another sideways glance at the Chasseur. The muscles along his jawline rippled, but his breathing was slow and steady.
"You are not Tau,"
he growled in low tones.
"Tau, serve the Tau Ver."
The panel ceased its descent now, juddering to a halt, bringing Epsilon's attention back to the procedure. Only a meter remained between the faces of predator and prey. The gene stealer's barbed tongue lashed out like a whip, once, twice. Still not close enough, but it sent the Tau prisoner into paroxysms of raw panic. Spit rimed his mouth. More flew with every scream. Epsilon recalled her surprise the first time she had watched a Tau infection, noting that the Tau had evolved tear ducts, just as humans had, and just as surprisingly, wept from them for many of the same reasons. That fact hadn't aroused any pity in her then. As tears rolled in rivers down the doomed prisoner's blue-gray cheeks, it aroused no pity in her now. At the push of a button by one of the Earthcast techs, the apparatus holding the limbless gene stealer shunted forward, about 60 centimeters. The prisoner's eyes went wide. All his panic and thrashing stopped dead. His mind had snapped, broken by the terror of the moment. The creature didn't hesitate. It plunged the sharp, hard point of its tongue deep into the flesh of the blueskin's neck. The Rauknar howled one last time, long and heart-wrenching. For a moment, predator and prey were frozen there, in a grim and horrific tableau. Then the beast retracted its tongue. The glistening, prehensile flesh disappeared behind those terrible teeth once again. And the creature became calm, its strongest urge satisfied. It had infected its prey as it had been born to do. It settled back into its restraints. The clamp retracted, pulling it away, and the panel began to rise back up into the ceiling, taking the monster from view. The prisoner, too, was becalmed, dull eyes gazing into space. The moment the tyrannid's tongue pierced his neck, it released not just its potent genetic material, but a cocktail of sedatives, relaxants, and mind-altering enzymes to ensure the prey did not fight back after infection, did not attempt to self-terminate. Before the package of tyrannid DNA began to work its mutative effects. By the time the prisoner awoke, he would truly be one of them. The Shan Ha, the Tau called them. The word had so many nuances. Rendered in imperial speech, it meant simply the infected. To Epsilon and to Blackseed, however, they were so much more than that. They were hope. Coldwave refused to match the woman's pace. Her long legs ate up the corridor at a far faster clip than his, but he would not hurry himself on her account. So he forced her to slow down as they walked to the area she always referred to as the creche. On the way, they passed the doorways to the birthing chambers. He scowled. He hated the noises from behind those doors. The sounds of Tau females giving birth should be a joyous thing. A music celebrating more members of the extended family that was their glorious race. But these births were dark, bloody, fatal affairs.
"This thing we do dishonors us all," he thought. "And it is my hands that are the filthiest."
The Aun had given ultimate permission, of course, but the project proceeded under Coldwave's direct authority.
The terrible impregnations were each authorized by him alone. All the blood spilled here at the prison at Nahavashak stained his name. And every time he passed these doors, the unnatural screeching of abominable newborns ripping their way out of their mother's bellies reminded him all too sharply of it. Of all the worlds and all the spheres, why did the damned woman have to be picked up closest to his? They could have killed her outright. Should have, perhaps. But she brought with her the promise of an answer to the biggest threat his people faced. Aunzi could turn her away. All too well did the town know the devastation wrought by the Tyranid race. The Yehe could be held at bay for a time, even redirected given adequate sacrifice, strategy, and good fortune. But they could not be stopped. Time was on their side. Eventually they would flood across the septs, consuming everything, and the glory and light of the Tau race would be snuffed out like a flame. He gritted his tooth plates. There was no way they could have refused the woman. She was not to be trusted, but without her research, without the data and the proposals and everything else she had brought to bargain with, there would be no hope for an end to the swathe of destruction the Tyranids perpetuated with relative impunity. He glared at her out of the corner of his eye.
"This had better bear fruit, you pale-skinned serpent, because if you have made us do this for no gain, I will sink my blade into you 100 times.
The sounds from the birthing chambers receded behind him. Coldwave realized he had sped his steps to expedite that, and became angry at himself, because he knew it would give away the depth of his discomfort to the woman. Did she enjoy his anguish at all this? Surely she knew by now how much it cost him every time. Easy for her. These were not her people they were inflicting horrors on. She claimed to have done much of that already, of course. Somehow, he suspected she felt just as little watching Gwela infection procedures as she surely felt watching the Rachna. The human Imperium's greatest monsters were not the war-mad giants in black armor, the hated Death Watch. The worst of them were smaller, apparently weaker ones that pulled all the strings. He resolved to remember that. It was easy to forget when faced with the might and ferocity of space marines, but this woman was more terrible than either of her slaughter-loving bodyguards.
"I bring you the gift above all gifts," said the woman suddenly as they walked abreast. "And yet, somehow, I fear you dislike me, Shasso."
Had she read his mind? Did she have that power too? Some of the Gwela, he knew, had impossible gifts, if she were such a one.
"You smell so badly of deceit," he said. "It hurts my face. How can any profess to like such a one?"
She laughed.
"Deceit? I give you the chance to save your people. Perhaps your only chance. I could ask for entire worlds, and such would be small payment."
He was disinclined to respond. She often tried to provoke him like this. He refused to let it work. Continuing in silence, they soon arrived at the doors of the creche. Heavily armed guards bowed in deference to the Shasso. He nodded back, enjoying their open disdain and lack of acknowledgement towards the foul woman, not that she seemed to care. The guard on the left turned to a panel and pressed his hand to it, and the doors hissed open. Coldwave and Epsilon passed through into the space beyond. Automatic security systems tracked them as they walked the short inner corridor that led to the main chamber.
"Have the Earthcast techs issued updated estimates on the birth of the first pure strains?"
Epsilon asked.
"I would have told you," he growled. "This is new ground for us too."
"That's why I said estimates, Shasso. The Earthcast ought to have some idea by now."
"The accelerated birth growth reproduction cycle is proving difficult to predict. A fourth-generation birth must be close. Perhaps today they will have news.
More guards, more heavy security doors, and beyond these, Coldwave and Epsilon stepped out into a cavern-like space above a transparent floor of toughened, acid-proof plaz. They stopped at the edge of a railing-rimmed walkway and cast their eyes down into the chamber below. It was impossible to stem the sudden surge of loathing and innate fear at what he saw. There were dozens of them, so miserably twisted, so sickening, like figures from the darkest imaginings of the pre-Enlightenment age. Noting the movement above them, the abominations raised their heads, gazing back at him, eyes shining with unnatural light. Some hissed or screeched, and in their mouths he saw smaller versions of the razor-like teeth of the tyrannid gene-stealers they used for first-stage infection. Many had additional limbs, the hands twisted into claws. On some, the hands had not developed at all. The bones of the forearms had grown into scythe-like blades. Coldwave had seen such things on the battlefield. He had faced pure-strain tyrannid forms. While he had lived, many he had thought stronger and better than he had not. The memories still caused him pain. He recognized the hallmarks of the tyrannid genetic material expressing itself in the horrors below. But these were stage threes. There was still much about them that was recognizably Tau. And that made it even harder to look upon them.
"Several of these are far along," said Epsilon, "ready for mating. Have any third-stage males been bred to third-stage females yet?" "While I was at the capital, yes," replied Coldwave.
There was an edge to the woman's tone now. He had ordered her and her bodyguards to be confined to the upper levels during his short absence from the facility. Much of the project was performed under her guidance, but he would not allow her access to the crash or the birthing rooms while he was not here to keep watch on her. There was still far too much she was withholding from them.
"If the accelerated gestations we saw in stages 1 to 3 are any indication," she said, "we could see our first pure strain within a matter of days."
"What then?" he asked. "You assured us of isolation from the hive mind. But how will we know it is permanent? How will we know it is not just the effect of your strange machine?"
"Your people are not as we are. There are ways to test for what we seek that I cannot explain in a way your science would understand."
"Human witchcraft, then. I have seen it. It is not a subject on which we Tau are entirely ignorant."
She grinned at that.
"There will be risks. I have told you already of the things I need brought from the Imperium. A rogue psyker, for one. Alpha class. If you are not so adamant about vetting all my communications."
"If our roles were reversed, you would do the same."
"You want results?" she said with a shrug. "You will have to make the requisite allowances. There is no reward without risk, Shasso."
He bristled at the way she spoke to him.
"If you attempt to burn us," he hissed, "to betray the trust we've placed in you, I swear you shall be the next one strapped to a table to await the Stealer's kiss."
Epsilon's face was a mask of absolute passivity. Not a single flicker of emotion crossed it.
"I don't doubt that, Commander," she replied. "Just remember that the Aun was free to reject my offer when I came to you. Suggesting an alliance took great faith and sacrifice on my part. It was no small thing to come here without the authorization of my superiors, but I stand by my decision.
Aunzi understands the need, as do you. Neither your race nor mine can hold back the dark that swallows all forever. And what I ask in return is so little. Data that cannot hurt you. Safe passage through your space. There is no knife hidden in my sleeve. No poison waiting to be slipped into your cup, Chasso. We see this through, and you may or may not get the weapon your people need. In any case, I get my promised safe passage, and you will not see me again.
Coldwave did not look at her as she spoke. As he listened, he found himself locking eyes with one of the mutations below. The creature glared at him, its face a sick and twisted mockery of his own, still Tau enough to be recognized as such, but too Tyranid to be allowed to live. It twitched and trembled with the compulsion to kill him, working its jaws as if it was already tasting his flesh.
"Curse them," he thought. "Curse them all, Gwela and Yehe both. And curse us for entering this damnable bargain. It may save our race, but it will rob us of all honor first. And the blood may never wash off."
Chapter 23. Even with night vision goggles set to full illumination, the going was tough. The walls of the tunnel were craggy and sharp, natural formations unsmoothed by the hands of men. Perhaps that was why the old tunnel still existed at all. It was unworked because it was unknown, not present on any map. Old Ganin was the only one ever to get out this way, and that was the year before the coming of the Blueskins. Ganin's memory of all the forks they had to take and tiny spaces they had to scramble through had not dulled even a little in all the years since he'd gained his liberty. Again and again the old man surprised Copley and her team. Every time she was sure she was looking at a dead end, he would push past her with a cackle and shuffle straight over to some utterly invisible gap in the rock, and they'd all be moving again. Without him, depending on his map and his notes alone, Copley and her infiltration team would have lost hours scouring the walls of each of these false dead ends for the way forward. Back at the Kashtu base, she had almost insisted that he stay. Ganin was physically frail, and would almost certainly be a burden to her team. A younger, colder Copley would have denied him his request for a last trip on the spot. His intel, she had thought at the time, would be enough. So why did she concede? On the flight south, staring at his lined and weathered face in the back of the Storm Raven, she had searched herself for an answer, and found none that satisfied her. Was she growing sentimental? Now, with the need for his guidance so apparent, she put it down to some intuition, something her subconscious mind had caught, but that her conscious mind was too arrogant and judgmental to see. She was damned glad he'd come along. Up ahead, Triskel, currently on point, pulled to a halt and threw up his right hand. She moved up to stand beside him and found herself on the very edge of a gaping black chasm. She shone her flashlight down towards the bottom of it. Nothing. The light hit nothing. She heard Ganin chuckle behind her.
"This was the hard part," he said. "This was the part where I was surest. I was doomed to die."
Triskel was shining his light to either side. The chasm filled the tunnel completely. No ledges. He turned it to the walls, looking for handholds. They were smooth.
"Lower, boy," said Ganin. "We have to go down a bit to go across."
"You cross this?" asked the trooper with some doubt.
"I didn't have a choice."
"We don't either," said Copley. She smiled at him.
"But we had the lizard in shadow, and he's done it before."
The old man grinned up at her, a gummy smile with just a handful of remaining teeth.
I have to go first. I can't tell it to you. Not so as you'd make it alone. I have to show you.
Do you still have what it takes? She asked him dubiously. He thrust his chin at the far side, shrouded in blackness even the squad's night vision goggles couldn't penetrate from this distance.
For all our sakes, let's hope so, he replied.
Ganin led, Copley followed, then Rice, Grigolitz, Morant, and Triskel. Grig was the strongest, so with everyone roped together, he was in the middle, the better to help out if anyone on either side of him fell. And if he fell, he'd have both Rice and Morant to pull him back up. It was beyond difficult. Without Ganin, it would have been truly hopeless. How many times in his mind, in his dreams, had he relived this deadly crossing? His old, big-knuckled hands unerringly found each invisible handhold, exactly as he remembered them. Twice he almost fell, but due to frailty, not to any mistake in his memory. Both times Copley moved forward beside him, drove a piton into the rock wall to secure both of them, and made sure he was good to go on. The pitons and lines would give them a chance to recover if one or two members slipped at once, but if more than that went down, she knew they'd all die. The rock was just too brittle to support the pitons if three fell. And so it went, meter by meter, with the old man methodically leading them from hand and foothold to hand and foothold, his eyes closed, feeling his way, remembering, until at last they rounded a final bend in the wall and began the climb up the chasm's far edge. Sweating, breathing through clenched teeth, Grigolitz and Morant pulled Triskel over. For a moment, they all sat, or lay sprawled on the rock.
"I never want to do that again," murmured Rice.
Copley looked at the old man. In the torchlight, his eyes were bright, like shining black gems. He looked vibrant, like the years had suddenly miraculously dropped away from him.
"Feel more alive than I have in decades," he chuckled.
"Thank you, Ganin," said Copley.
"That was really something, old man," said Grigolitz, grinning broadly.
"Still a little ways left," Ganin told them. "But it gets a lot easier from here."
It did. He had them scramble up a few walls to ledges that were invisible from the tunnel floor. He showed them around rocks to apertures that were just big enough to squeeze through. But then something about his energy, his demeanor, changed. And Copley felt that this was a moment the old man had been waiting for.
"This is the last one I need to show you," he said as he pointed along a narrow fissure in the rock she hadn't even seen until he had drawn attention to it. "After this, you just follow the map I drew. There's nothing hidden from here. It's just about choosing the right tunnels now."
She glanced at her men, then back at Ganin.
"You can come with us into the base," she said. "You'd have to stay in the tunnel underneath it, but when we extract, if you're quick enough to get out and get on one of the storm ravens..."
The look in his eye stopped her.
"That's not how this is meant to go," he said. "This place has been waiting for me, just like I've been waiting for you. Speaker said so. I'd have died years ago, except he told me I had to live on till you people showed up."
He tapped his chest.
"Got the rot in here. 6 years now. But the speaker told me. He said, the lizard in shadow must wait for the coming of the Reshva. The Imperium has a need for you, Ganin. You cannot die until you fulfill it." So I lived. But now I get to rest.
"Here?" said Copley.
"I'll go back a ways. Sit by the chasm's edge a while. See if the God Emperor will spare me a word or two. Now that I've done my duty."
he chuckled, turned and pushed past the troopers, all of which towered over him. As he passed them, each put a hand on his shoulder and said, "Ganin." When he was a dozen meters away, he half-turned and spoke one more time.
"Never met a woman who was more warrior than a man before, Major. Reckon those blueskins have no idea of the storm that's about to hit them."
He laughed and turned back in the direction of the chasm.
"Give them hell, girl."
Then he was gone, swallowed by shadow, off to make his final peace with himself and see out the last moments of a long life. For a few long seconds, Copley stared at the curve of rock around which it disappeared. It looked peaceful, ready. She wondered if she would feel like that when her time was up. She and her men were about to enter a base crawling with Tau forces. Nothing they hadn't done before, of course, but any time could be the last. No one on her task force expected to retire.
"Ma'am," said Rice.
She looked up and found him staring at her.
"Lead on, Rice."
He nodded and set off along the narrow path Ganin had shown them they must take. The rest of the squad followed in silence. They edged along in the close confines of the tunnel like worms, the rocks scraping at them and their loadouts, forcing them to adjust their kit frequently, to exhale and push hard to get through the narrower spaces. Packs and weapons often had to be dragged along behind them, with one of the operators at the back to help push them through whenever they got caught or stuck, which was more frequently than Copley would have liked. And all the time, the mission chrono kept ticking off crucial seconds. Talon Squad and the rest of the assault force was counting on her. She couldn't afford to fail. Karras and the others couldn't rush the facility while the defensive batteries were still in play. They'd be shot down without any chance to fight. In truth, Copley was anxious. Not about gaining access to the facility, not so much about any resistance she and her team would face, but more about getting into the Tau electronic systems and shutting them down. Reading and operating Tau holomenu systems was one thing. She'd done that before in the field. But an ultra-secure facility like the Tower? Surely there would be encryption, and not light encryption either. With the possible exceptions of spaceports, Firecast headquarters, and Tau intelligence hubs, the systems at the Tower were probably the most secure on this planet. She had brought her best people for this, but there was no guarantee it wouldn't be beyond them. So much could go wrong.
"So what's new?" she thought.
Sigmar had made sure Copley and her people were superbly equipped for Shadowbreaker. The Inquisitor Lord knew these were long odds. Some of the new toys her people had been assigned were impressive. That thing Morant was carrying, that hacking module. Her task force had not been given access to something like that before. It was something new, at least to her. Great if it worked. But she knew better than to trust mission success to tech. It was people who carried the day. All the advanced gear in the galaxy wouldn't mean a damn without the right people for the job. She looked ahead at the back of Sergeant Morant and was reassured. The short, surly former drop trooper had been extensively trained by the tech priests of the Mechanicus in the use of the module. In fact, just in case Morant went down, several team members had been educated in its use. But Morant had a natural talent for the thing. She was counting on him to secure the Tau security and control networks at the Tower when the time came. Such rare technology. If only she'd had it in her Militarum days. So many lives. It had to be part of the Ordo Xenos.
"Even so," she thought. "Even so."
This whole op still hung by such a fragile thread. Common sense told her it was madness for Talon Squad and the others to try to force their way in if she and her squad failed in their infiltration. But the importance of acquiring Epsilon, knowing she was here, was so paramount that even if Copley and her four-man unit died before taking out the anti-air batteries, the Death Watch Storm Ravens would still launch their assault.
They'll be swatted out of the damned sky, but they'll fly in and try for it anyway. We can't risk giving the Tau a chance to move Epsilon. We take her here and now.
The point man, Sergeant Grigalitz, voxed her from up ahead.
The tunnel opens out here, ma'am. Room to stand. A little cavern about 2 meters high, 3 meters across. Just like the old man said.
Understood,
Copley replied as she pushed forward through yet another tight bottleneck in the rock walls.
Start checking the cavern roof. Ultraviolet, infrared. From what he said, the scene can't be discerned with the naked eye.
Grigalitz was still searching for it when Copley, Rice, and Morant joined him. Morant hung back at the entrance to the little chamber, helping Triskel get the kit through the last gap. When it was done, Morant turned his goggled eyes to the ceiling with the others and helped search. Triskel unhooked the squad's portable Auspex scanner from his webbing and adjusted the dials, eyes glued to the tiny lambent screen.
The old guy must have been good in his day, said Morant. He did this in complete darkness, right?
I can't find a damned thing, even with the goggles at max, ma'am.
Nothing on the Auspex either, added Triskel.
Copley stopped what she was doing.
Turn them off.
Morant turned to her.
Ma'am?
Your goggles, all of you. Turn them off. He didn't depend on his eyes, neither will we. Use your hands. Just feel for it. A tiny seam with the slightest give, it's here somewhere.
Unless it was discovered and sealed.
No, she wasn't about to accept that. It had to be here. She pulled off her combat gloves, reached up to the ceiling and let her fingertips probe the rock inch by inch. 8 minutes later, Morant muttered,
Wait, ma'am, I think I've got something.
He didn't move until she was right by him. Even then, he kept his fingers exactly where they were, lest he lose the seam. Copley reached up, her fingers tracing the rock in a small circle around his own. And there it was. There was the slightest give in a part of the rock when she applied upward pressure. This was what the old man had talked about. This was the aperture through which, malnourished and blind in the dark, he had dropped, not knowing what was below. Luckily for him, and now for Copley and her people, he had not plunged to his death, but instead had found a narrow, twisting path to freedom. He had found his way out, and back into the hands of the tribe that had counted him among the vanished.
And there he waited, for us to come. Thank you, old man.
Too early for thanks, perhaps. The aperture could still have been sealed from above in the intervening years. Thinking this, Copley freed her knife from its shoulder sheath and worked the point into the seam, then dragged it along, clearing it.
It'll be heavy, she told her squad. I want the four of you right underneath it, pushing directly up. When it comes free, shift it gently to the right. Take your time. If any of the blue skins are in earshot...
Carefully, the squad pressed the slab-like rock free, and with great care and patience, moved it out of the way. At first, it was silent, but as the space opened further, Morant and Triskel had to let the stone go. It was up to Rice and Grigalitz to push it aside, and that meant the unavoidable sound of heavy stone scraping on stone. They took it as slow and steady as they could. When they were done, all five members of the unit waited, breath shallow, ears attuned to the slightest noise. Triskel took the Auspex from his webbing again and slowly swung it full circle.
Nothing showing, ma'am? Okay, said Copley with a nod. Looks like we're still good to go. Grig, back on point. Get up there.
Aye, ma'am, said the soldier, and he hauled himself up into the darkness of the space above the chamber.
Seconds later, his gloved hand appeared, thrusting downwards to grab his weapon and pack. Triskel handed them up.
How is it looking?
Asked Copley.
Cramped, said Grigalitz. Water and power lines everywhere. Looks like the Tau didn't change any of this. No sign anyone has been down here in a long time.
He was silent a moment, then added,
Nope. Nothing running through them now. Obsolete. The Blueskins must have installed their own systems on the upper levels. Looks clear, ma'am. Not seeing any laser trip lines or monitor lenses. No electronic signatures.
The Blueskins are confident,
thought Copley. And why wouldn't they be? Since they'd arrived, this planet has been theirs. With the exception of a token rebel force they could obliterate at any time, there was nothing on this world to make them think an assault on the tower would ever come. Not that she was about to get complacent.
I'm up next, she said.
She moved underneath the opening. Again, Grigalitz thrust his hand down. She grabbed it and jumped and was swiftly pulled up. A moment later, she reached down and Triskel passed up her kit. In the unnatural green hues of her goggles' vision enhancement, Copley made out a low-ceilinged tunnel filled with a jumble of old pipes and cables. It reminded her of dense jungle strewn with creepers. She wondered if cutting through any of the tangled cables would give her and her people away, because it looked like they may well have to do so in order to press further. The floor of the tunnel was natural rock, but unlike the little cavern below, this had been cut by las and plasma tools. It was easy to see that by the melt marks. The ceiling was smooth and angular, thick blocks of grey rockcrete reinforced with girders of riveted iron. There was just enough room to walk hunched over, but the profusion of pipes meant dragging their packs behind them in some places.
Triss, she murmured.
The trooper checked his auspex.
Lot of interference here, ma'am. But, again, nothing showing. No movement.
She activated the holo compass on her left wrist, then tapped it off again.
The old man said to go north from here, about 200 yards. There should be an access hatch, but it's not the one we want. Another 100 yards after that, the tunnel swings east. We're looking for the first access hatch in the ceiling after we turn that corner. You got that, Grig?
Moving off now, ma'am.
By the time they found the hatch they were looking for, Copley had noted the sweat running from her hairline and down the back of her neck. It was getting warmer the further they went. Good. It meant they were closing on an energy source somewhere above them. They were pushing deeper into the complex. Carefully, her men opened the hatch, senses hyper-alert. There were no Xenos awaiting them above. This part of the complex seemed to be more or less abandoned, or at least infrequently patrolled. One after another, Copley and her team hauled themselves up. After handing his pack and weapon up to Triskel, Rice was the last to ascend. He, Triskel, Morant, and Grigalitz replaced the stone hatch as carefully and quietly as possible, while Copley surveyed their surroundings and checked her holo compass again. With the hatch back in place, the squad stood in a rough circle, backs to the center, weapons raised, awaiting Copley's command. To the north and south, the corridor ran off into pitch darkness. There were work looms set in the walls, glowing a dull red. Enough light that the squad no longer needed their goggles. The air was alive with the deep humming of some kind of power generator. Copley moved to the wall on her left, the west wall, and pressed her cheek to it. The rockcrete was warmer than the air temperature suggested it ought to be. Listening hard, she thought she recognized the sound. That particular tone and frequency was familiar.
A large-scale plasma generator, she said. 2 or 3 levels above us. Probably the main power source for the whole base.
She'd blown up more than a few of them in her time.
Explains the interference on the auspex, said Triskel. Damn thing is all but useless in here. Ma'am, said Rice, shouldn't we rig it to blow? We could take down every system they've got. Plus, it would be a hell of a diversion if we find ourselves pinned down.
Grigalitz snorted.
Taking down their systems like that could cut off access to a primary objective. Besides, they'll have a backup for critical systems, maybe even a backup for the backup. We'd just be kicking the nest.
Rice was the youngest, fastest with a blade, deadly accurate with a las gun, able to move as quietly as a leaf on a breeze when he had to.
but he lacked the long experience of the others.
"We'll ignore the generator," said Copley, "and stick to the original plan. We get inside their security systems and take things from there. This is no demo job."
She gestured up the tunnel with the muzzle of her lasgun.
"Up ahead should be the old stairwell Ganeen used. From there, we make our way to the sub-tunnels that run under the storage block. Just pray to Terra and the Golden Throne that the Blueskins haven't dumped a bunch of heavy crates over our only access point."
Copley's luck, or the Emperor's blessing, whichever it was, it held. The Tau hadn't covered the final hatch. There were no crates atop it. She and her men slipped into the vast, gloomy space of a storage depot on the east side of the facility, not far from the north wing where Alal Atarag's human inmates were kept. They heard movement as soon as they emerged. Copley signaled for everyone to stay low and hang back, then slid from cover to cover until she had a better vantage point. Tau voices, jabbering and clicking as they always did. She knew the dialect well. Two low-ranking Earth caste members on a rest period, making small talk about their most recent arranged matings. This depot was being used mostly for the storing of foodstuffs, judging by glyphs on the containers. A southern section was given over to banks of equipment for the recharging of power modules. Two modified TX-4 Piranha skimmers were parked just inside the rolling plasteel shutter of the west wall. They were without armament, probably just used to taxi supplies over to whichever prison block needed them. Aside from the two Earth caste workers closest to Copley, a mix of Tau workers and human auxiliaries moved to and fro, ticking things off on checklists or hefting crates. None had noticed the arrival of the five Imperial soldiers. Copley returned to her team and pointed up towards the ceiling.
"That's where we need to be. That upper walkway. There's an observation room top and center. It'll be manned, and there'll be some kind of control and communication systems there. Let's not give them anything to report. Once we pass the observation room, we continue on the gangway, going north. There's an exit in the north wall, upper level. You see it? From that, we can access the enclosed bridge that will get us into the mid-levels of the central block. It doesn't look like they modified the general structure of the place all that much. That's good for us. The old stairwells should still be in place. We don't want to use Tau Veta shafts. Careful and quiet. Any one of you gives us away, I'll shoot you myself."
They grinned at that. They'd heard it before. She motioned for them to follow, and one by one, with adaptive camouflage systems blending them into the background, they moved from cover, quietly making their way to the plasteel frame that supported the overhead walkways. Copley went up first, climbing swiftly and silently, her slender muscles bunching and rippling as she pulled herself from strut to strut. Within moments, she was at the top, crouching on the gangway. She wasn't even breathing hard. It was good to be out in the field again, to feel alive like this, to put her skills to use. At times like these, she knew she wouldn't have traded this life for anything. Crouching low, trusting the others to keep pace, she moved along the walkway towards the door of the depot observation room. When she reached it, she crouched at the edge of the doorframe and slung her lasgun over her shoulder. She drew a wickedly curved, black-bladed knife, flipped it into a reverse grip, and waited. Rice joined her first, settling against the opposite side of the doorframe and throwing her a nod. Within seconds, the others had stacked up beside them. Copley used battle sign, her fingers forming words and sentences in place of her mouth. In this silent language, she ordered Rice up and over the roof of the control room and down onto the walkway on the other side. It was risky, sending one of her team up and over like that. A single noise at the wrong moment might give them all away. If even one of them were spotted at this early stage. But she trusted Rice. Since his selection for Arcturus 4 years ago, she had shaped him, molded him,
to the point where he, like every other operator on her team, felt almost like an extension of herself, like a particular sword in the hands of a master swordsman, like a part of her own body. As Rice pulled himself up and crept across the roof of the room, he moved with the cautious stealth of a panther approaching skittish prey. His every movement was careful and coordinated. In due course, he dropped silently down to the walkway on the other side and hunched himself against the doorframe, and there he waited. Copley nodded to the others. She reached up a hand and tested the door. As expected, it was unlocked. Slowly, carefully, she pulled it open and moved silently inside. A stocky Tau in a dark blue jumpsuit sat at a bank of monitors and controls. Munching on the pungent black seeds that the Earth cast seemed to love so much, Copley knew the smell. The seeds were toxic to the human liver, but the Earth cast Tau couldn't get enough of them, snacking on them almost constantly. That crunching and munching was her ally right now. As she crept quietly and carefully towards the Tau's back, all he heard was the sound of his own grinding tooth plates.
Earth cast!
Unmistakable, and not just for the smell their favorite food gave them. Their bodies were shorter compared to those of the other castes, but far denser, far thicker in bone and muscle. Approximately 5 feet in height, some weighed in at 100 kilograms, and they were never fat. They were the lifters, the laborers, the inventors, the creators, the engineers. Copley raised her knife and readied herself for a clean, swift killing blow. Exhaling between her teeth, she put considerable strength behind her strike. The point of the knife bit her victim exactly where she wanted it to, between the third and fourth vertebrae, utterly separating the key nerves located there and immediately paralyzing the target. The body shuddered. There was a soft, sucking sound as the Tau desperately fought to breathe with lungs that were no longer responding. The blue heart slowed and died, and the inert form of Copley's victim began to slide from its stool. Copley caught it, grunting at its weight, and lowered it quietly to the floor. She quickly checked the control console for any glyphs that would indicate security systems or door locks.